The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the April 8th, 2022 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is set in front of the Supreme Court building. Judge Clarence Thomas is standing with his wife. He's wearing his traditional Supreme Court justice robe. She's got on a blue T-shirt with a Q on it. It says, question the narrative. She's got a button that says, stop the steal. And she's got a Make America Great Again hat on it. They're holding hands and they're looking at each other with big smiles on their faces. The headline is, Power Couple. Does Jenny Thomas Stop the Steal activism create a conflict of interest for her husband? And that's going to be our controversy of the week. But we'll start with the first main story. Russian assault continues after withdrawal vow. What happened? Russian bombardment of Kyiv and Chernihiv continued this week after the Russians claimed they no longer plan to seize those cities and would drastically reduce attacks there to increase mutual trust during peace talks. Faced with a bloody stalemate in western Ukraine, Russian defense officials announced that they had completed the first stage of their operation by degrading Ukraine's military capabilities and would now turn their attention to their main goal, the liberation of the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. The claim came after weeks in which Russian troops have been stalled outside of Kyiv and other northern cities, sustaining heavy losses and being driven back in counteroffensives. But officials in Kyiv and Chernihiv said intensive strikes on civilians continued unabated. Russian troops spent the whole night hitting Chernihiv, said Governor Vladislav Chaus. Weeks of bombardment of Ukrainian cities have killed thousands of civilians, forced millions to flee their homes, and created a severe humanitarian crisis. Peace talks resumed in Istanbul, where Ukrainian officials offered a peace proposal. It calls for Kyiv to end its bid to join NATO and commit to neutrality in exchange for security guarantees, with a cohort of countries that would intervene if Ukraine were attacked. Ukraine, for the first time, offered a framework for negotiations over the future of Russian-occupied Crimea, while the Russians opened the door for a meeting between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Russian President Vladimir Putin to discuss the future of the eastern Donbas region to which Russia has laid claim. Lead Russian negotiator Vladimir Medinsky called the opening meeting a constructive step. Meanwhile, Russia's pounding of southern cities continued. In Mykolaiv, a Russian assault partially destroyed a nine-story government building, killing at least a dozen, according to local officials. Mariupol, where local officials say 5,000 citizens have been killed and 90% of the city has been leveled, remained under continuous heavy shelling, according to the British Defense Ministry. What the editorial said. With enough help, Ukraine can still win this war, said the Wall Street Journal. But the Russian dictator's nuclear blackmail seems to have succeeded in intimidating Biden and other NATO leaders who have slow-walked delivery of weapons and switchblade drones. If these threats deter the West from giving Ukraine the weapons it needs, next time an emboldened Putin will threaten to nuke NATO countries themselves. The alliance must make clear that any use of nukes or chemical weapons will be met with a requisite response. With his military bogged down and battered, Putin retains one very powerful weapon, said the Washington Post, continuing European reliance on Russian energy, which blasts a hole in otherwise crippling Western sanctions. Western allies must be creative and aggressive about curing their addiction to Russian fossil fuels. What the columnist said. Russia may truly intend to scale back its territorial ambitions to the Donbass, said Andrew Fink in the Dispatch. But Putin will insist that Ukraine cede the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. And even if Zelensky were willing to take that deal, it'd be a hard sell for Ukrainians who are riding high from their military victories. Putin's only winning strategy is to inflict enough misery on the Ukrainian population to make them desperate for some kind of resolution. We Ukrainians will not surrender any territory to Russia, said Ukrainian journalist Natalia Gumonyuk in the Washington Post. Ukrainians know that Russian occupation means seeing their communities destroyed and watching Russian forces round up government workers and journalists and punish dissent with imprisonment or death. Besides, Ukrainians believe they can win. 93% said so in a recent poll. If Ukraine gave up the Donbass in exchange for peace, Putin wouldn't stop there, said Thomas Grant in the Wall Street Journal. He'd use the parts of Ukraine he's stolen as convenient launch pads for menacing and attacking other parts of Ukraine, which would see sham independence movements orchestrated by Moscow. The partitioning of Ukraine by force will set the stage for future war on former Soviet republics Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and possibly even the four NATO countries on Ukraine's border. The risk for the security of Europe are clear. Peace is not in sight, said Eric Levitz in New York Magazine. Russia claims to be negotiating, but its forces continue to rain shells and missiles on civilians and will likely make territorial demands Ukraine can't accept. U.S. officials say Putin's plan B, now that he can't take Kyiv and install a puppet leader, is to annex not only the Donbass, but almost all of Ukraine's Black Sea coastline, so that Russia acquires a land bridge to Crimea. That leaves scant hope for a diplomatic resolution, and with the struggle for Ukraine mired in a stalemate, there's little prospect of a military one either. As soldiers on both sides dig in, this catastrophe has only just begun. The controversy of the week, as we saw with our cover drawing, Jenny Thomas, a full-blown conspiracy theorist. The public has been losing faith in the Supreme Court for years, said Elliot Williams in CNN.com. Now the biggest current threat to the court's legitimacy is the extremist partisan activism of Virginia Jenny Thomas, wife of Justice Clarence Thomas. In 29 unhinged, conspiracy-laden text messages that were leaked last week, Thomas repeatedly urged then-White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to overturn the 2020 election. In Thomas' messages, which Meadows turned over to the House's January 6 committee, Thomas implores Meadows to keep fighting to keep President Trump in power, claiming that Biden and the left is attempting the greatest heist of our history. That's right, said Dan Baltz in the Washington Post. The wife of a sitting Supreme Court justice called for a coup, using kooky language like "release the Kraken" and echoing false claims that election machines had been rigged. In January, Justice Thomas was the lone justice in an 8-1 ruling to side with Trump's effort to keep his White House communications and records secret, and his reasons for the dissent were never publicly explained. To salvage the court's credibility, Thomas now needs to recuse himself from all cases involving the 2020 election and the January 6 Capitol attack. Let's take a step back here, said Jonathan Turley in TheHill.com. Rightly or wrongly, many Republicans shared her belief that the election had been stolen, and her messages to Meadows were constitutionally protected advocacy. She has repeatedly said that she and her husband keep their professional lives separate. The text messages certainly aren't flattering, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But why did they leak now? Could Democrats be seeking to damage Thomas right before the Supreme Court hands down major decisions on gun and abortion rights? Sure enough, many liberals are already demanding that Thomas resign from the court altogether. The problem goes deeper than these texts, said Jesse Wegman in the New York Times. The Thomases have been brazenly flouting the most reasonable expectations of judicial rectitude for decades. This is a couple who have described themselves as so close they are melded into one being. Throughout their marriage, Jenny Thomas has been paid hundreds of thousands of dollars by conservative activist groups that have taken strong stands on issues before the court, such as abortion, Obamacare, and Trump's Muslim ban. Yet Justice Thomas has refused to recuse himself in those cases, even though his own household is financially and ethically compromised. He and his wife have created the impression of extreme bias. Jenny Thomas' text made another thing crystal clear, said Jacob Silverman in NYMag.com. Just how deeply QAnon craziness has penetrated the GOP. She espoused a connoisseur selection of the most bizarre beliefs from the conspiracist buffet, including references to secretly watermarked ballots and the belief that the Biden crime family would soon be arrested and sent to Guantanamo Bay for ballot fraud. And this isn't just some wingnut posting on a QAnon site. She's married to a Supreme Court justice with far-right views who has the power to help implement her agenda and protect her, Trump, and other January 6 conspirators from the legal repercussions of an attempted coup. And yet Republicans continue to fiercely defend Thomas and make excuses for his blatant conflicts of interest. The rot is deep. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for the Russia hoax after former President Trump called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to release any dirt he might have on President Biden's son, Hunter. I would think Putin would know the answer, Trump said. It was a good week for proof of collusion after Russia claimed that Hunter Biden secretly funded biological weapons research in Ukraine. State TV host Evgeny Popov said that it's time to change the regime in the U.S. and to again help our partner Trump to become president. And it was a good week for gay pride after a same-sex couple adopted a dog that was recently dumped at a North Carolina animal shelter because his previous owner feared he might be gay. We face the same ignorance, said Steve Nichols, one of the dog's new owners. It was a bad week for reproduction after a U.S. Census report showed that the population grew at the slowest rate in history in 2021. From 2011 to 2017, the U.S. added about 2 million people a year, but last year it was down to 393,000. It was a bad week for the GOP caucus, which was irate after Representative Madison Cawthorn, the Republican from North Carolina, claimed that fellow members of Congress have invited him to participate in a, quote, sexual get-together, that is, an orgy, and that he's seen some legislators do a bump of cocaine. And finally, it was a bad week for data scientists after a study by British psychologists found that the most boring person in the world works in data analysis, lives in a small town, and watches a lot of TV. Presumably, he does not participate in congressional orgies. And a short and other news piece on this page. White House asks for a tax hike for billionaires. President Biden proposed a 2023 federal budget this week with new taxes on households worth more than $100 million that would generate $360 billion in a decade. Under the Biden plan, those households, 0.01% of Americans, would pay at least 20% of their income in taxes and would also face a tax on the increase in the value of their liquid assets, such as stock. The change would have a major impact on company founders who hold billions of dollars in shares. The White House also called for a partial rollback of the 2017 tax cuts for corporations. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts, praised Biden's budget, while Senator Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, threatened to derail the plan, saying the gains Biden wants to tax exist only on paper. The briefing this week is titled, The Role of Oligarchs in Russia. The U.S. and its allies are going after the assets of Russia's billionaires. Will sanctioning them hurt Putin? Who are the oligarchs? They're the dozens of ultra-wealthy Russians who schemed and swindled their way to control of Russia's most lucrative industries. The term oligarch was coined by Aristotle, but became popular in the 1990s when a handful of entrepreneurs and hustlers took advantage of the sudden privatization of the Soviet economy to buy up natural resources and formerly state-controlled assets, using rigged auctions and other tricks. A few even took control of companies based on ownership documents they'd produced on home printers. The first generation, most prominently Roman Abramovich, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Boris Berezovsky, and four others, became the country's chief power brokers, essentially buying President Boris Yeltsin's 1996 election win for him. Vladimir Putin succeeded Yeltsin in 2000, in part through promises to eliminate oligarchs as a class. But that didn't happen. A 2017 study conducted by the U.S.-based National Bureau of Economic Research found that Russia's wealthiest elite had at least $800 billion stashed abroad, roughly equal to the total wealth of Russia's remaining 144 million people. What did Putin do? The ex-KGB officer wrested control of Russia's corporations and wealth from the seven biggest oligarchs. He triggered a prosecution and imprisonment of oil tycoon Khodorkovsky and forced two others, Vladimir Guzinski and Berezovsky, into exile. Berezovsky would die under suspicious circumstances 10 years later. By using state contracts like fiefs, Putin cobbled together a new, more tightly controlled oligarch class from old St. Petersburg friends, fellow KGB alumni, and other members of the Siloviki, the state security, police, and military elite. By 2009, according to a paper published by the intelligence firm Stratfor, 78% of Russian business and government leaders had ties to security organs, including the FSB, the KGB's successor agency. This group is extremely loyal to Putin, largely sharing his grudges about Russia's failed experiment with economic liberalization, and his paranoia about the West. How has the West responded? The U.S. is currently sanctioning more than 400 Russians and is looking into the finances of at least 50 oligarchs and Putin cronies. One chief target of U.S. and European Union sanctions is Igor Sechin, Putin's one-time secretary who owns oil giant Rosneft and is widely considered Russia's second most powerful man. Others singled out include brothers and construction magnates Arkady and Boris Rotenberg, as well as restaurateur Yevgeny Prigozhin, who helps fund the notorious St. Petersburg troll farm that that spread disinformation during and after the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The U.S., U.K., and EU have seized or blocked movements of at least 9 multi-million dollar superyachts, including those belonging to Sechin, metals tycoon Alisher Usmanov, and Gennady Timchenko, owner of an energy trading firm. In his recent State of the Union address, President Biden announced the creation of a new Justice Department task force charged with hunting down Russian billionaire assets. "We are joining with our European allies to find and seize your yachts, your luxury apartments, your private jets," he said. Is that making a difference? Post-invasion economic disruptions have cost Russia's 20 richest billionaires about a third of their wealth, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. But the U.S. faces major logistical hurdles in its attempts to punish individuals. Because government investigators must establish a link to criminality in the U.S. to actually seize domestic Russian assets, it can take years to build a case or even prove ownership, as oligarchs conceal their holdings in layers upon layers of shell companies scattered throughout the world. And researchers warn that even the most punishing sanctions are unlikely to make oligarchs take the risk of pressuring the autocratic Russian president to change course on Ukraine. "It's not the 1990s, said Tufts political science professor Daniel Drasner. "These are people who owe their position to Putin." So are these efforts useless? No. Draining the coffers of Putin's bankrollers will make the invasion more difficult to sustain and clarify what future costs they will face for continuing to fund his bloody aggression abroad. Unease is growing among the Russian elite, particularly among those with foreign residences and passports. Banker Mikhail Fridman and aluminum magnate Oleg Deripaska, both targets of Western sanctions, have publicly called for an end to the war. But University of South Carolina professor Stanislav Marcus, a specialist on the oligarchs, warns that imposing further sanctions on the highly visible globetrotters will probably not accomplish much. Instead, they should more precisely target the silovarchs, those with a presence in the state security and military apparatus, as well as the boardroom. "It is the guns, not the money," he said, "that speak loudest in the Kremlin today." It's time for a few of the best columns. We'll start with two from the U.S. Is Trump exempt from prosecution? The failure thus far to prosecute Donald Trump for any of his astonishing number of crimes is deeply corrosive to our democracy, said Jonathan Chait. We learned last week through a leaked resignation letter that Mark Pomerantz, a prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's investigation of Donald Trump's company, strongly believe that Trump could be proven guilty of numerous felony violations for falsifying financial and tax records. The district attorney, Alvin Bragg, decided not to pursue an indictment on the grounds that Trump's criminal intent would be hard to prove. Now, certain crimes are difficult to prosecute, and Bragg is certainly prudent to avoid risking an acquittal. But there are mountains of evidence that Trump is a career criminal who routinely commits fraud, violates laws, and obstructs investigators. Special counsel Robert Mueller documented at least 10 acts of obstruction of justice in Trump's successful cover-up of his campaign's entanglement with Russia. Yet Trump escaped prosecution, just as he has for his blatant attempt to overturn the 2020 election. That leads to the cynical conclusion that there are different rules for the rich and powerful, which is a genuine triumph for Trump. Why women don't compete against men. What is the purpose of women's sports? Asks Megan McArdle. That is the critical issue in the debate over whether transgender athletes like college swimmer Leah Thomas should be competing in the women's category. Thomas, who swam in college as a male for 3 years, recently won the 500-yard freestyle race in the women's category at the NCAA championships. That prompted a backlash from other teams and even some of her teammates, who contend Thomas had an unfair biological advantage, years of higher testosterone levels she experienced growing up male, which made her taller, stronger, and faster than most women. Progressive advocates of inclusion argue that most great athletes have significant physical advantages over their peers. So why exclude Thomas and other trans athletes? But dismissing the innate biological differences between men and women is an argument for eliminating women's sports altogether. Women's sports exist to give women the experience of teamwork, camaraderie, self-discipline, competition, and the chance to win without having to compete against males. Women's sports are defined by biology. That's why most people will never believe that pitting a trans athlete against a cisgender woman is anything like a fair fight. This is an international column from Afghanistan. Taliban boots girls from school. When Afghan girls excitedly arrived for the resumption of high school last week, said Rafiullah Anwari in the Afghanistan Times, they were crushed to be ordered home instead. After seizing power in Afghanistan last year, the Taliban initially shut the schools but promised that girls would retain many of the rights they had gained over the past 20 years, including the right to an education. All other schools have since reopened, and girls' secondary schools were about to restart too, but at the last minute, Taliban abruptly changed course. They claim, implausibly, that the girls' schools lack sufficient female teachers and proper uniforms right now, but most people believe the closure is permanent. Manzeh, an 11th grade student in Parwan province, said that when she and her classmates were told the Taliban would keep their schools above sixth grade shut, we all returned home crying. The UN Security Council called on Afghanistan to immediately reopen the schools, while the U.S. canceled a scheduled round of economic talks with Taliban emissaries in Qatar. These are strong reactions, but they're unlikely to make any difference. The Taliban are leading this country into the wilderness, said Habib Hamidzadeh. Their false claim that current school uniforms violate Islam shows that their views on education are more tribal than Islamic. The Taliban won't come out and say it, but they simply do not believe in educating girls, and closing schools is another step toward achieving the complete elimination of women from society. Afghan women are taking it upon themselves to fight this regime that has been forced on them, said Afghan activist Friba Rezaei. In Kabul, hundreds of girls and women marched in the streets for days demanding they be allowed to return to school. They pointed out that their uniforms are similar to those girls wear in other Muslim countries. Even the Prophet Muhammad said everyone has the right to education, said Nawisa, one of the students protesting. But the Taliban have snatched this right from us. Yet this despicable act should come as no surprise, said Naeem al-Hashimi al-Kafaji. The whole world knew of the Taliban's extremism and criminality, and nobody really believed that they would keep their promise to educate girls. The United States should have known better when it recklessly handed over Afghanistan to the Taliban last year, leaving the Islamist radicals free to suppress and persecute Afghan women. It may want to wash its hands of the 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, but Washington still bears the responsibility for this human rights disaster. Even so, girls shouldn't give up hope, said The National from the UAE in an editorial. The Taliban's dithering on reopening schools signifies deep divisions within their own ranks. Some members appeared ready to open girls' schools throughout the country, but more conservative voices in rural areas had last-minute reservations. It's not much consolation for now, but the Taliban's disunity could be catastrophic for their future rule. And good news for Afghan girls. We've got an interesting title to our feature article, The Last Word. It's called Disneyland for Seniors. In the Villages, the country's biggest retirement community, retirees escape the loneliness of old age with parades, conga lines, games, and tribal politics, a journalist, Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. Which side are you on? A highly animated older gentleman named Ray Ray is shouting in my ear, demanding to know my political orientation. You still haven't told us. I am tucked into the outdoor bar of City Fire, a popular watering hole in the Villages, the massive senior living community in Central Florida that has gained notoriety as a MAGA stronghold. After a couple of cold, drizzly January days, very un-village-like, residents keep assuring me, people are eager to fraternize once more. Inside, the restaurant is crowded with patrons nodding along to the live music or cutting loose on the small dance floor. Outside, where heaters and plastic sheeting hold back the chill, folks are packed together watching golf on TVs, taking advantage of the $3 happy hour beer, and swapping stories at top volume. It's a boisterous crowd. Villagers, as the community's 130,000 residents are known, tend to be an outgoing bunch. They are perpetually coming up to introduce themselves and then quiz you about yourself. These folks love a good party and a good argument. I'm talking with a small gaggle of veterans, all men, all supporters of former President Donald Trump, about voting rights and voting fraud. This is a hot topic in Florida, where Governor Ron DeSantis has become a crusader for voting restrictions, or guardrails, as he calls them. It is also a topic with fresh relevance at the Villages, where four residents have been arrested in recent months on allegations of voting twice in the 2020 election. Three of the four were registered Republicans. Legally speaking, double voting is a no-no, the kind of fraud a certain former president and his followers might consider worth fretting about. Not my City Fire companions. You're talking about four votes out of more than 100,000 people, objects Ray Ray. In fact, around the Villages, where Republicans outnumber Democrats by more than 2-1, I haven't run across many conservatives perturbed by the possible fraud in their midst. Some profess to know little, if anything, about the arrests. Others, like Ray Ray and his buddy Marty, are fired up about voting fraud generally, just not the kind where a few of their neighbors may have done something careless or stupid. To the contrary, these vets say they know what real fraud looks like. They hail from places like Michigan and Pennsylvania, where the cities, they say, are rife with electoral malfeasance, some of which they claim to have seen firsthand. Marty insists Detroit is a disaster. The piddling, isolated incidents that maybe happened here, they could not care less. And the fact that I am asking about the issue tells them which team I root for in the great blood sport of American politics. As if being part of the fake news media weren't bad enough, the men have already warned me that there is a gun-toting regular whom I should avoid tonight if I don't want trouble. Marty and Ray Ray are, of course, joking. Even in the midst of a political rant, the residents here are an overwhelmingly helpful, friendly bunch. That is, after all, the motto of this place, as trumpeted on the banners hanging all around the town squares. The Villages, America's friendliest hometown. But for many, friendly is not the first word that springs to mind to describe the Villages. The conservative community has long been a campaign stop for geopoliticians, but the rise of Trumpism dialed up the tribalism. The enclave became known as a hotbed of partisan brawling during the 2020 campaign. Public screaming matches erupted. Property was vandalized. Neighbors stopped speaking to one another. Mahjong groups and golf foursomes broke up. That summer, a video went viral of a villager shouting, "White power," during a golf cart parade celebrating Trump's birthday. The episode introduced the villages to the broader public, and not in a good way. This senior Mecca, the nation's largest, emerged from humble roots. In the early 1980s, H. Gary Morse, a one-time ad man, took over his father's mobile home park in an unlovely patch of Florida cow country. Some of the mobile units can still be seen in the northern end of the villages, which residents euphemistically refer to as the historic district. Morse soon realized that to draw people to this landlocked region en masse, he needed to give them amenities, and lots of them. Soon followed the golf courses, swimming pools, shops, restaurants, movie theaters, sports facilities, rec centers, of which there are more than 100, and endless clubs, 2,900 plus. Today, the villages isn't so much a retirement community as an empire, a collection of dozens of neighborhoods covering more than 32 square miles spread over three counties, with the bulk in Sumter County. It boasts more than 60,000 households and is expanding fast. Dump trucks and excavators swarm the developing areas, and new buildings spring up practically overnight. Housing prices are out of control, gripe residents. I checked out a lovely but modest home in the village of Chitty Chatty that was priced around $460,000. Thanks to the thousands of new villagers who arrive each year, the villages has been the fastest growing metro area over the past decade. The village's bellicose politics has made it a subject of fascination and horror for many, but its portrayal as a MAGA circus misses the core of its appeal, especially among the tsunami of retiring baby boomers who are aiming to redefine aging, much as they reshaped every aspect of the culture. Seniors don't move to the villages for the politics. They come for the golf and the pickleball, the softball and tennis and polo. They come for the concerts and casino nights and the senior games. Think of them as more mature Olympics. They come for boozy bingo at Lazy Man's Tacos, karaoke night at City Fire, and the line dancing taught by a DJ called Scooter. Just ask the Democrats. If I were to not talk to any Republicans, then I wouldn't have many acquaintances, said Mike Falk, the president of the village's Democratic Club, who notes that in his golf group of 16, he is the only Democrat. Chris Stanley, the immediate past president of the club, says she gets asked why on earth a Democrat would want to live in the villages all the time. Her answer, because life here is amazing, and she loves it. The enclave has been called Disney for retirees. The comparison is apt, not only because of the nonstop amusements. Its entire aesthetic is too studied and precious to feel like the real world. The three quaint town squares and main retail areas were developed around themes: Spanish Springs, Lake Sumter Landing, and Brownwood Paddock. The streets and public areas are spotless and beautifully landscaped, and everywhere you go, there are golf carts. Golf carts are key to understanding the villages. There are over 90 miles of cart paths here, and it is a point of pride that every corner of the community is cart accessible. The vehicles are an expression of residents' individuality and independence. People are serious about tricking out their rides. They paint them with flames, name them, and plaster them with bumper stickers. Those with money to burn splurge on carts that look like vintage autos. Even seniors who have no business driving anymore zip around like teenage joyriders, say residents. Crashes are not uncommon, and visitors are warned to watch out for bad drivers and drunk ones. Golf cart parades are part of the culture. Villagers use any excuse to organize one. Christmas, Halloween, the start of a big Supreme Court case, delivering their ballots to the polling station. Andy Kleiman considers the parades the most fun part of the local political life. You go by and see all these people giving you the thumbs up, he beams. Of course, you're likely to get other fingers waved at you as well. It is easy to mock all the clubs and events as boomer hedonism mixed in with golden years YOLO nihilism. Eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you may get diagnosed with shingles or need a double hip replacement. And the frenzied socializing can definitely veer in that direction. Residents mention that alcohol abuse is a real problem here, and for years the community has fought its reputation, based in part on a 2008 book, as a den of sexual iniquity, where seniors get jiggy in golf carts and STDs run rampant. Many villagers are definitely on the hunt for companionship, and the men are quick with an offer to buy a gal a drink. But the parades and games and clubs, most definitely the political ones, also give people a sense of belonging and purpose, of still being able to make a difference. Whatever their ideological persuasion, residents are constantly reminded that civic engagement matters, that they matter. Like at all retirement communities, the social life at the villages tackles head-on the scourges of isolation, despair, and loneliness that are eating away at so many Americans as the nation's social fabric frays. In a culture that can feel as though it is leaving seniors behind, the villages is designed to bring people together. And despite the at times harrowing political warfare, the community largely succeeds in doing so, even if it isn't always easy. People here feel responsible for one another. Marty Schneider, of Marty and Ray Ray, is a long-standing member of the Band of Brothers, a group of mostly Vietnam-era vets founded over a decade ago. As Schneider puts it, give veterans who were having trouble somewhere to go. People were really struggling and some died by suicide, he recalls. What began as a small gathering on Tuesday afternoons at City Fire has morphed into a 501c3 organization with several hundred members that puts together social outings, bowling, golf, etc., and community events, and holds weekly raffles and other fundraisers to support veterans and related causes. The central problem, of course, is that the sense of belonging may flow as much from who is not a part of the villages as who is. The populace here is 98% white, putting it increasingly out of touch with the broader nation. The entire place, in fact, has a time-warped quality. It is reminiscent of college or summer camp, but for the people who no longer have to worry about what they're going to be when they grow up or what their political choices will bring, for villagers, the future is less of a concern than living their best life. Right. Now, here, boomers still reign supreme in a place that caters to some of their most self-absorbed, self-indulgent impulses. The culture, like the overwhelmingly conservative politics, can feel like a scrupulously maintained bulwark against the onslaught of time and change. Early one evening, I settle in near the Sumter Landing bandstand to watch the Hooligans, a local favorite that plays all the classics. Pink Floyd, The Clash, The Police, Rod Stewart. At one point, a trim, relatively young woman sporting short dark hair and a golf visor wanders over to ask if I'm the band's agent, noting that I look very official sitting there with my notebook. After quizzing me about who I work for and why what I'm working on, she introduces herself succinctly. Brenda, strong conservative and strong Christian. She and her husband are snowbirds visiting from Minnesota, spending their second winter in the villages. They love it here. Except, Brenda has noticed a distinct lack of diversity, and she's not entirely sure if that's an okay thing. On the other hand, she adds, it feels safe, because anyone here who doesn't belong stands out. And with that, she drifts back into the sea of seniors, swaying as the band belts out Radiohead's Creep. What the hell am I doing here? I don't belong here. A version of the story was originally published in the New York Times. Read an obituary this week. The refugee who became America's top diplomat, Madeleine Albright, 1937 to 2022. Madeleine Albright fled despotism as a child and grew up to fight it as America's first woman Secretary of State. Born in Czechoslovakia, Albright was a refugee twice over by the time she arrived in the U.S. at age 11. Her family having escaped first from the Nazis and then from Soviet communism. She rose to become U.S. ambassador to the U.N. under President Bill Clinton in 1993, then served as America's top diplomat from 1997 to 2001, making her, at the time, the highest-ranking woman in U.S. history. Guiding U.S. foreign policy in the aftermath of the Cold War, Albright promoted an assertive internationalism and was a forceful advocate of using U.S. power to support strategic aims and confront atrocities. She championed NATO expansion and pushed for Western intervention to stop genocide in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Rwanda. 4'10" with a piercing gaze, Albright was a charismatic figure who spoke six languages and was known for blunt talk. The oft-repeated quote came after the Cuban military shot down a pair of civilian aircraft carrying four Cuban exiles in 1996. "This is not cojones," she said, using Spanish slang for testicles. "This is cowardice." She was born Marie Jana Kobrilova in Prague, where her father was a Czechoslovakian diplomat, said CNN.com. After the Nazi invasion in 1939, the family escaped to London, where her father worked for the Czech government in exile. The family returned to Prague after the war, but fled again when the communists seized power in 1948, heading this time for America, where her father taught international relations at the University of Denver. Albright studied political science at Wellesley, then married a wealthy newspaper heir, and settled in Washington, D.C., said the Washington Post. She became an influential Georgetown salon leader while raising three young daughters, then went back to school to earn a doctorate in government from Columbia. There she studied under Zbigniew Brzezinski, who brought her into the White House as his congressional liaison when he was named President Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor in 1977. After the Carter years, Albright taught at Georgetown University and served as an advisor to Democratic candidates on foreign policy, said Politico. She met Clinton while working for Michael Dukakis' failed 1988 campaign. "Her intellectual clarity and toughness made a big impression," Clinton later wrote. And when he was elected in 1992, he made Albright UN ambassador. At the UN and within the administration, she lobbied for intervention in Bosnia, where Serbian forces were slaughtering Muslims in an ethnic cleansing campaign, and in Rwanda. She said later the administration's failure to stop the genocide of ethnic Tutsis was her biggest regret. When Clinton nominated Albright for Secretary of State at the start of his second term, she was confirmed by a 99-0 vote. 10 days later, her story took a dramatic twist, said the Telegraph. The Washington Post revealed that Albright, who'd been raised Roman Catholic, was actually of Jewish descent, with three grandparents who'd perished in the Holocaust. Her parents had embraced Catholicism shortly before the outbreak of the war and presented the children with a fictionalized past. Albright said she was stunned by the revelation. A pioneer as a working mother at the top levels of international power, said Reuters, Albright was an inspiration to many women and often said, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. The first top U.S. official to meet Vladimir Putin when he became Russian president, she wrote that he was cold and reptilian and determined to restore Soviet greatness. After leaving the White House, Albright founded an international consulting firm and returned to teaching at Georgetown, said the New York Times. She wrote many books, including a best-selling memoir, and remained an outspoken commentator on current events. It took me a long time to find my voice, she said in 2020, but having found it, I'm not going to shut up. Flipping over to the Talking Points page, we have an article, Jackson Hearings, the GOP's Revealing Questions. Conservative Republicans tried last week to smear Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson as a radical leftist with extreme views on race and crime, said E.J. Dionne and Jr. in the Washington Post. But choosing the low road backfired spectacularly. Confronted with false charges and vile innuendo, President Biden's Supreme Court nominee was poised and patient, and her confirmation is now nearly assured. Republicans, meanwhile, shame themselves by descending into backlash politics and mean-spirited culture war tropes designed for Fox News soundbites. They hounded the first black woman nominated to the high court about critical race theory, which Jackson has never embraced, and misrepresented her experience as a public defender to suggest she sympathizes with criminals and terrorists. GOP senators even pursued a despicable and factually false line of attack on Jackson's sentencing in child pornography cases, attempting to brand a devoted mother of two as soft on child porn. Jackson withstood the bullying, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate, but Democrats should have asked her to do more than block punches. Confirmation hearings are political theater, and Jackson should have been given a chance to articulate a progressive judicial philosophy that contrasts with conservatives' ongoing attack on LGBTQ rights, marriage equality, contraception, and abortion. Jackson did try to spell out her judicial approach, said Brandy Barnett in the Wall Street Journal, and it sure sounded like she's an originalist, the philosophy championed by the late conservative Justice Antonin Scalia. I believe that the Constitution is fixed in its meaning, Jackson said. It's appropriate to look at the original intent. Even more surprisingly, Jackson disavowed living constitutionalism, which, as she explained, infuses the Constitution's text with the policy perspective of the day. Jackson is no conservative, but her embrace of originalism is proof of the triumph of Scalia's thinking across the ideological spectrum. The hearings were really not about judicial philosophy, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. Senators with 2024 presidential ambitions, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, and Tom Cotton, competed to throw red meat to MAGA extremists. Even worse, they pandered to the delusions of QAnon followers who believe that Democrats and deep state bureaucrats are running a secret child sex trafficking ring. That's why Hawley and Cruz focus so obsessively on Jackson's supposedly lenient sentences for people caught viewing online child porn, even though conservative legal experts concede that Jackson's sentences were in line with the judicial mainstream. With their demagoguery on critical race theory in schools, gender issues, and what Cotton called the breakdown of society, Republicans teed up the GOP's midterm elections message. Liberals are soft on criminals and other abnormal people and hostile to parents and children. The concerns Republicans expressed no doubt resonated with many Americans, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner. In a now infamous exchange, Senator Marsha Blackburn asked Jackson if she agrees with liberal icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg's opinion that there are physical differences between men and women. When Jackson balked, Blackburn asked her simply to define the word woman. Jackson replied, "I can't because I'm not a biologist." "Consider the exquisite irony," said Michael Brendan Daugherty in National Review. Biden vowed to choose a black woman to sit on the court, and now his nominee can't explain what it means to be a woman. What a victory for the trans movement. Every progressive is now bound by their sense of duty in the culture war to explain sex isn't binary, that gender is some mysterious internal state, and that parents and doctors should defer to any teen who decides they are born into the wrong body. Outside the hearings, the GOP senators revealed their full agenda for the court's 6-3 conservative majority, said Jamel Bowie. Blackburn condemned the court's constitutionally unsound ruling, Griswold versus Connecticut, a landmark 1965 case that struck down a restriction on married couples buying contraception, and in doing so established the constitutional right to privacy. Senator Mike Braun of Indiana even questioned the validity of Loving versus Virginia, which struck down a state ban on interracial marriage, saying when it comes to states' rights, you can't have your cake and eat it too. He later tried to walk that back, but the message was sent. As the sun sets on Roe, said Melissa Murray in the Washington Post, Republicans seek to eliminate not only the right of privacy, but any rights established over the past 70 years that aren't explicitly defined in the Constitution. In coming years, the court will determine whether we as individuals will be permitted to control the most intimate aspects of our lives. And a quick quote from Bette Midler for you. The worst part of success is trying to find someone who is happy for you. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.